Hi, Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Ashley Flowers.
And I'm Britt.
And today, I'm taking you back to the 80s, to a case that really defined a generation and forever changed the way we grew up, the way we parent, and the way law enforcement treats missing children cases. This is the murder of Adam Walsh. And since I'm taking you back to the 80s with our story, we've sent our theme song back to the 80s too with the help of one of our fans, Johnny. It was around 12:15 on July 27, 1981, when Reveille Walsh was making her way from the Lamp Isle at Sears to a video game display station to get her son. They had gone there to get some very specific lamps that her husband John told her were on sale, but the store didn't end up having any in stock, so the trip was kind of a bust. When they had come in, Adam was begging to play the game. I mean, like, what six-year-old kid wants to just look at lamps? So Reveille had left him there with a group of kids, but when she rounded the corner when she was coming back from the lamp section, the game station was totally empty. And I have to imagine, at first, her thought wasn't like immediate panic. She was gone 5, 10, maybe 15 minutes tops. Like,
right.
He probably went looking for her. And Reveille even said in an interview with ABC that the last thing she said to Adam when she left him was, "I'm going to the lamp section." And he says, "Okay, mommy, I know where that is." So, you know, my logical thinking is that she was probably thinking like, oh, he went to look for me. Somehow we missed each other.
Yeah, just like past each other in the aisles or whatever.
Yeah. So she began to search up one aisle, down another. No Adam. Up another aisle. No Adam. Like, is it possible they're just missing each other?
Yeah, like they're just missing each other again. Like, she's in the lamps when he's at the games. He's at the lamps when she's at the games. It's just,
right.
It just happens. I get it.
Right. So eventually, Reveille asked the store clerk to page Adam overhead. They ask him to meet his mother in the toy section, which is where like the games would have been. When Reveille walks back there, she sees someone she knows. And I imagine it's just like relief that washes over her because it's her mother-in-law. She must have Adam. Now, they didn't come together, and neither of them knew that the other was planning to be there, but surely Adam had found her, and this is the only explanation. But Adam's grandmother was just as confused as Reveille. She tells her, no, like, he's not with me. The two wait in the toy aisle for what feels like an eternity, and still, Adam does not appear. Eventually, what's happening becomes clear to everyone. Someone calls John, who rushes to the scene to be with Reveille, and by 1:55, the police are called. All the store clerks who are working are questioned, but impossibly, no one says that they saw Adam at any point. There was an incident that the store manager mentioned to Reveille, though. She said that a group of boys had gotten in a fight over the game and whose turn it was to play, or like who had controlled the joystick or whatever. And the security guard had kicked all, like, this group of boys out. The problem, though, is that when they showed the security guard, who was this young female guard who just started on the job, they show her a picture of Adam. She says that she doesn't recognize him as one of the boys she told to leave the store.
Okay, but if he actually had been kicked out of the store, that would make sense, right? Like, why he wouldn't be responding to the overhead pages?
Right. And to top it off, the kids that all got kicked out were sent out of the store's west entrance, which isn't the same one that Reveille and Adam had come in. So when they went to go look for him outside, I'm sure Reveille was even worried because she's like, you know, he would have had no idea where he was. And she said in her husband's book, Tears of Rage, that Adam was super shy and probably wouldn't have told the lady, the security guard lady, that he didn't know where he was or that he wasn't with those boys and his mom was still inside. Aww. Like, he would have just kept quiet and gone outside to the sidewalk. So now their biggest fear isn't that Adam is wandering the store, but that he was maybe one of those boys put out of the store despite what the guard told them. And now he might be wandering outside lost and alone. As afternoon turns to evening, it becomes more and more clear to both John and Reveille that something worse could have happened. And when that horrible day turns into 2, turns into 3, and then 4, everyone is sure wherever Adam is, whoever he's with, he isn't able to get home on his own. In the time right after Adam went missing, John took point for the family, and he was the one in front of cameras, trying to get on every single news station, making sure that Adam's picture was spread far and wide. They had no idea where he could be at this point or how far from home he was. But in those first few days, police weren't super concerned with far and wide. Police thought that the answers to Adam's whereabouts were much closer to home. Because you see, when they did their initial interviews of the family and those closest to them, the lead investigator uncovered a secret that he thought was the key to solving the case. That lead investigator was a guy named Jack Hoffman, and right away he learned that the Walshes weren't the perfect family of three like he first thought. You see, Reveille openly told Hoffman that she had had a long-running affair with one of John's closest friends, a man named Jimmy who'd been living with the Walshes up until about a week or so prior to Adam's disappearance. But Reveille had recently just cut off the affair. John was in the hotel business, so he traveled a lot. He worked long hours, and even though he was quite literally obsessed with Adam, and he was a wonderful father when he was home, at times he wasn't the best husband to Reveille. And she found a lot of what she needed emotionally in his friend Jimmy. And Jimmy started to become really close to Adam too, almost like a second father.
Okay, wait, I have a question.
Yeah.
You said this guy lived with them, but just recently moved out before all of this. Did he leave because the affair ended, or did the affair end because he left?
Actually, none of these. So the affair had ended because John and Reveille were going to start trying for another kid. But from my understanding, Jimmy still lived there after that. It was actually John who kicked Jimmy out, not because he found out about the affair. He actually had no clue until after Adam went missing. But he just didn't like how close Jimmy was with Adam. He was Adam's dad, and he wanted to make that, like, perfectly clear. I can imagine it'd be confusing as a young boy. Like, there's the guy who's always at home, always with you, doing all the things with you. Mm-hmm. And then your actual dad who, like, comes and goes. And John just, like, wanted to, like, really delineate those lines.
I guess that makes sense.
But he didn't, like, kick Jimmy out of the family. Like, they were all still very close.
Right. He was just like, let's create some distance here.
Yeah, let's set some boundaries.
Physically, but yeah. You're still emotionally involved.
Right. So when Detective Hoffman hears about this drama, his gut says to him that Jimmy is his guy. His theory is basically that Jimmy was spurned by revenge, cut off from a boy he thought of as his son. But again, there's a little problem with this. Like, Jimmy wasn't cut off from Adam. He couldn't live with Adam anymore, but he saw him all the time and even in the days leading up to Adam's disappearance. So it's kind of theorized often, like, if Jimmy wanted to take Adam, I think it was said he was at the movies with him the night before, just take him then. Why, like, try and steal him from a Sears with his mom? Like, it doesn't add up, but this Detective Hoffman guy really believed in his gut that that was what happened. A big problem with this theory, though, to me, and I don't know why it wasn't seen by Detective Hoffman, is if Jimmy had Adam, wouldn't he have been very easily found? Like, Jimmy was with the Walshes almost the whole time as this stuff unfolded. Where would he have kept him? They obviously, like, went and checked his home. It's very confusing. And obviously, Adam wasn't found. For 2 weeks, his parents did every appearance they could trying to bring him home until they got a fateful call on August 11th. Just the day before, now this is about 2 weeks after he's been missing, a child's head had been found in a canal about 130 miles away from the Sears in Hollywood, Florida, where Adam was last seen. Now, it wasn't an entire child, just a head. And though it was badly decomposed and bloated, it was obviously a young kid. Now, it could only have been one boy, but they had to be sure. The dental records, or like the x-rays, aren't included in the official case file anymore, but it was said in the Bringing Adam Home book and a couple of places online that Adam was identified by a family friend, and that family friend looked at Adam's mouth to determine it was him. Mm-hmm. You see, if you ever look at the pictures, like one of the most iconic pictures, I think, in true crime of Adam's like missing person picture, the one they use of him with like the baseball bat, he's got this big toothy smile. And when he went missing, it was obvious that teeth were missing from his mouth. And so when they found this head, it said that like the missing teeth were to have matched up according to this family friend. John and Reve were informed about the discovery on the 11th, right after being on Good Morning America, pleading for Adam's safe return home. They knew where he was now, but this was absolutely not closure for them. Now they had to wonder who had taken Adam and how had his head gotten 130 miles away and where was the rest of him? Answers were elusive in those first few months, but an arrest came in November of 1981, the same year that Adam was killed, that gave everyone hope that they might have answers. So in November, a man named Edward James was arrested for abducting another boy. This guy's cellmate told police that he'd been talking about Adam, and when they looked into this guy, they found out that he was MIA for about 2 weeks in late July / early August. The timing was perfect, and it made him look even more suspicious when they found out that he'd recently gotten a new seat cover installed in his car. The exact kind of thing you would have to do if you maybe had a severed head or any part of a body in your car, right?
Yeah, definitely. Super suspicious.
Now, there aren't a ton of details about the time between when this guy was arrested and when police gave him an official voice stress analysis test, which wasn't done until 1995. But you don't hear a lot about this guy. And when you look up this case initially, I thought police probably knew something about him as a suspect that allowed them to rule him out way early on, but it's just not included. But the more I learned from the book Bringing Adam Home by Les Staniford and Sergeant Joe Matthews, the more I am sure that suspects weren't properly vetted. And that's the problem. It's not that maybe they knew something that they could rule him out early. Even if he was a really good-looking suspect, there were a lot of really good-looking suspects that they did not properly vet. A future investigator, Sergeant Joe Matthews, heavily criticized the lead detective Hoffman and basically said he had blinders on for that family friend Jimmy. Despite the fact that Jimmy took two polygraphs and passed, despite the fact that he went under hypnosis voluntarily, didn't divulge anything incriminating, and despite the fact that John Walsh, even after learning about their affair between Jimmy and his wife, would later still back up his friend and say he was not involved in this. What was alleged is basically that if another suspect came up, Hoffman would spend more time trying to eliminate them as a suspect than trying to see if there was any actual evidence connecting them to the case.
Okay, but isn't this, like, kind of a good thing? I feel like we've seen, like, so many cases where a suspect pops up and all anybody focuses on is all the signs that point to them and try to make the evidence, like, fit the situation. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
Like, I feel like we just have a better and more fair legal system if anyone came in as like the devil's advocate and was like, okay, but what doesn't fit? What isn't pointing to them?
No, I totally agree, but I think you hit on the right word there, which is fair. A fair investigation looks at both sides. You know, how is this person connected, but also what is showing that maybe they are not. Mm-hmm. But it seems like looking back on Hoffman's investigation, the focus was solely on proving that suspects could not have done it. And there's no better example of this than when looking at the way Hoffman investigated two notorious serial killers whose names have been associated with the Adam Walsh case for decades, since way early on, and that's Otis Toole and Jeffrey Dahmer. The name Otis Toole first entered into the case file in 1983, just 2 years after Adam had been killed, and at a time when I'm sure everyone was worried that things were going to go cold. Otis was in jail on other murder charges completely unrelated to Adam, and while in prison, he began confessing to other crimes. And of all of his crimes, he said, there was one and only one that he felt bad about. Mostly because of the victim's age. It was a young boy that he'd taken from a Sears. At first, again, this isn't like a totally different area. The investigators have no idea what he's talking about. But when police interviewing Otis were able to make the connection and bring in the Hollywood investigators, Otis was still more than happy to talk. And his story was so eerily similar to the facts that he couldn't be written off right away. Otis said that shortly before Adam's murder, he'd taken a bus down to Florida. He was kind of a drifter and he had some family in Jacksonville, but he would basically roam around the state in a car that he'd rented from a family member. Now, on this day in question, he said he was window shopping at a wig store near a Sears in Hollywood when he saw a young boy just standing outside of the store. He said there was something about the boy that he liked and he wanted to keep him and raise him as his own. So he asked the boy if he'd follow him to his car where he had like some candy or toys or whatever. And he basically took the boy by the arm and the boy went willingly. Of course, there was nothing in the car, but Otis kept the kid calm by telling him like, oh, all this stuff's just at my house. I'm going to take you there. But as they drove further and further away, the longer the boy was in the car, the more upset he became. He wanted to go back. He wanted his mom. And eventually, Otis knew that his plan wasn't going to work. He was not going to be able to keep this kid without this kid freaking out. And the more the kid cried, the more upset Otis got. He ended up hitting him across the face. And eventually, Otis said that he pulled over the car and used a weapon from his trunk to cut the boy's head off. He said he wanted to keep the head with him and initially had thrown it on the floorboard of his car, like in the back, but later decided that it would be a really bad idea.
Yeah, I feel like all of this is a really bad idea.
Yeah, obviously. So he said later he threw the head into a body of water. And basically the place he described was exactly correct with where Adam's head would have been found. So this looks pretty good, right?
Yeah, but I guess I'm trying to figure out where things go off the rails, because any real crime junkie knows that this case wasn't solved for like 3 decades or something, right?
Right. The problem is in 83, Otis's story kept changing, and over years and years, it kept changing just enough that Hoffman didn't like it. Like, do you remember the episode we did on Lloyd Lee Welch a few weeks ago?
Yeah.
So his story did the same thing. It evolved each time, putting himself closer and closer to the center of the case.
But there was always this element of truth.
Exactly. Otis did the same thing too. Small parts of the story changed. Like, at first, Otis said that he did it. Then he said his friend and his lover, Harry Lee Lucas, did it, and he was just there. But it was easy to prove that Henry was in prison at the time, so that was obviously false. Mm-hmm. So then he mentions, like, multiple different weapons used to cut off the head. He talks about a bayonet and a machete. He talks about how, you know, first he hit Adam, and he was unconscious when he chopped off his head. Then he said he strangled Adam, and then he was already dead when he chopped off his head. Like, there's all these different stories over and over and over. And the sticking point is, when it came to the critical piece of evidence that could prove whether or not he did it, showing police the location of Adam's body, his story changed yet again. First, it was that he buried it near where he decapitated Adam. And they tried to look there, but they weren't able to find anything. Then he says he took him to his mother's home in Jacksonville. And they go there. They find stuff, but not a ton of stuff. Like, the details changed, but the core of the story stayed the same. And what's so interesting is that the Detective Matthews guy, one of the co-authors of the book I keep referencing, he's actually the guy that picked up the Adam Walsh case like years later and ended up solving it. At one time in his career, and he still might do this to this day, I don't know, he taught interrogation techniques. And he says there are 5 stages that these offenders often go through when they're telling you about their crimes. And the first stage is they're not involved at all. Like, they'll deny everything. They have nothing to do with it. They don't know anything about it. Then you can like talk to them and pull more stuff out of them. And when you hit stage 2, it's like, okay, I know something about it. I know who actually did it, and I can implicate someone else. And then they keep going and going and hit stage 3, which is, okay, I was there, but I didn't actually do it. I was just like involved somehow.
Right. Like, every stage, they get a little bit closer to the actual crime itself.
Exactly. Right. And stage 4 was like, okay, I was involved, but I only helped. And by stage 5, like, they're the only person left and they completely did it. Mm-hmm. And he said it was clear that Otis was like going through all these stages. So around 83, 84, Otis was in the news a lot. The public knew that the police were looking at him as a suspect in the case, and they knew he'd been confessing to the crime. At one point, police even said an arrest would be coming any time now. What wasn't widely known to the public was that no arrest ever came. Many people for years would go on thinking that Otis Toole was responsible for this and had been arrested for it, but there was actually no official closure to this case. For years, investigators would go back and forth with Otis Toole, taking confession after confession, trying to connect him physically to the crime. But like DNA wasn't much to talk about in the early 80s. Nothing Otis owned could be genetically linked to Adam. Everything came back as inconclusive. And when the mid-90s rolled around and we had like real DNA starting to become a thing, everyone was just out of luck because not only was the carpeting from Otis's car missing, but the entire car itself couldn't be located. Their biggest piece of evidence to prove if he was really linked to Adam and if his stories were real or not was just gone.
What?
Yeah, it's like they were just hitting one wall after another, trying to get any corroborating evidence that Otis could have done this. And if we jump back to Detective Hoffman and how he investigated Otis, one of the major problems people point out decades later was it seemed like he was trying everything he could to put Otis in Jacksonville on the day of the kidnapping, but put almost no effort into finding any evidence that Otis was in Hollywood on that day.
But why? Like, it seems like he was such a good suspect.
Again, everyone kind of thinks that the original detective still wanted it to be the family friend Jimmy. And if it didn't like fit into his theory, it didn't work. Like a lot of stuff I've read has just said that it was a lot of ego involved at this point. Now, Hoffman wasn't only dismissive of Otis Toole, he was even more dismissive of another suspect that the true crime community is very familiar with, and that's Jeffrey Dahmer. And if you look online, there is still a lot of people who've written books or done websites or blogs that claim Dahmer is the real killer of Adam Walsh.
Yeah, I always remember his name coming up. Jeffrey Dahmer operated really close to where we grew up in like Chicago, Milwaukee area, but I never really remember like why they always connect him to Adam Walsh.
Yeah, because it is a lot farther outside of his normal operating area. And I think it's largely in part to the fact that Dahmer's MO was decapitation. I don't think Otis Toole ever decapitated any of his victims after Adam. But Dahmer did all the time. And after he was caught in Milwaukee, it ended up coming out that he was in Florida at the time of Adam's disappearance. But I read a couple of articles from the Sun Sentinel and like the Miami Herald that literally all the investigating that was really done into him was having the Hollywood guys go up to Milwaukee. They had one sit-down chat with Dahmer where he said, "Nope, wasn't me." And that's it.
That's it?
No polygraph, no like looking into background checks.
No like follow-up?
No, they just said like, you know, he's been confessing to everything. So if he did it, surely he'd confess to this. And like, I mean, it's a little bit crazy to me because he told police like, well, you know, one of the reasons he didn't do it, he's like, "I didn't even have like a vehicle at the time. It wouldn't have been me." But it would come out years later that he did have access to a vehicle. It was actually a blue van where he worked. And this is a little bit irrelevant, a little bit of a rabbit hole, but a blue van was actually one of the biggest red herrings in Adam's case for a long time. There was a witness that said they saw a kid being pulled into one, and that was a report in like the very early days. So everyone talks about this blue van, blue van, blue van, but it turns out that the timeline ended up being all off. Like that sighting didn't happen until almost an hour after Adam actually went missing. So people still are trying to connect Dahmer to this blue van, but I think everyone's forgetting. I don't think this blue van is super relevant. And the people who keep these websites and blogs going and going often have these like tangential personal connections to the case. Like either they say that they were a witness, or they say that they know other witnesses that have come forward to say that they witnessed Dahmer in the area or at the very Sears that day. Now, even though I think the Dahmer angle warranted a little more investigation at the time, hindsight tells us that it would have been a waste because it took 27 years, but the truth was finally revealed, and it was revealed in the most bizarre of ways. Despite the fact that most of the general public thought the case was long since solved after police made an announcement about the impending arrest of Otis, the case was actually very much unsolved and got increasingly colder year by year. The more time passed, the more evidence was lost, the harder it was to talk to witnesses, and John and Reveille never got justice for their son. Now, they did go on to have three more children. Their marriage almost broke under the weight of losing their firstborn, but the two were able to work through it. And as anyone who isn't living under a rock knows, John went on to host one of the most successful shows in TV history per the Ashley Flowers rating system, America's Most Wanted. And that launched in 1988 and was incredibly successful at apprehending wanted persons. It was, at least to my knowledge, the first real example of solving crimes by crowdsourcing. But despite all the crimes John was able to bring closure to, his own sons remained an open wound. According to multiple sources, John had decided long ago that Otis Toole had been responsible for killing his son, and he and his wife felt like the Hollywood police botched the investigation. At one point in time, John actually got a letter from Otis himself, and it was horrible. And I'm not even going to read it on here, even though it's available online, but it demeaned Adam while taunting John of what may or may not have been done to his son. And the point of the letter was extortion. Otis wanted John to pay him, and in exchange for payment, he would tell him where the rest of his son's body was. But if Otis thought John was going to pay the man who killed his son, he was sorely mistaken. On September 21st, 1996, John aired what he thought was going to be his last episode of America's Most Wanted. And on that would-be last episode, he finally covered his son's case and talked about his prime suspect, Otis Toole. I think it was more about closure, maybe, than trying to get tips. Mm-hmm. But oh, the tips they got. A woman called in and said she was in the Sears that day. She saw Adam playing the game and also saw a man near the kids who she said matched Otis Toole's description. But more than just looks, everyone who talked about Otis Toole talks about how horribly he smelled. And rancid is the word that keeps getting used over and over and over. She said that she was going to come forward and talk about this man, but all of the stuff on the news talked about this kid getting pulled into a blue van. And she thought at the time, well, clearly, like, they have more relevant information. Me seeing this was way before he got pulled into a van. So what I have isn't relevant at all. So she never came forward. Another man came forward to say that he actually was one of the boys who was playing the game with Adam. And when they were put outside, his mom had come to get him. And he said, oh, I don't want to leave this little boy alone. And his mom said, no, look, he isn't alone. Like, his dad's right there. And that's when the kid saw Adam being led away by this, like, messy-looking man. Now, over time, more stories would come to light like this. Another person said he was driving and saw Adam being led away by his arm to a car. But all these years later, he thought the guy who did it had been caught because he actually saw Otis, like, back in, like, 83, 84 when he was on the news and the police are saying, you know, we're going to make this arrest. And he's like, oh, crap, that was the guy. I know what I saw. Mm-hmm. But obviously they have him. I don't need to come forward. So he never did.
Oh, my God.
All these leads felt like they could mean something. But there was one more call that came in and the caller's news was shocking. And they said, hey, don't you all know the suspect that you're looking for is dead? No, no one had known. Otis had died in prison of cirrhosis of the liver, and not a single person knew. And with this, the case seemed like it was dead too. But John's show was not. AMW got revived, and life continued on for the Walshes. However, they could not let go. In Reve's interview from 2020, she said, quote, when all this was going on, I just thought to myself, I can't wait until it's 20 years or 25 years. I don't care about getting old. I just want this experience of my life to be that far away from me because I thought it would be different. It's really not. End quote. Time wasn't changing the hurt. They needed closure. So finally, Reve and John sat down with one of their trusted investigator friends, Detective Sergeant Matthews, and they asked him to take a final look at the case. Once and for all, come at it with fresh eyes and tell us what you find. Matthews reviewed the tens of thousands and thousands of documents, and this is when he determined what we already know. The investigation into Otis Toole was sloppy at best. He uncovered a ton of information that drastically changed how we view this case. Like, one small example is, you remember that security guard? She was brand new, 17, and she said, like, I kicked a bunch of boys out, but I don't recognize Adam.
Yeah.
At some point, she had come forward and said, no, I know he was one of the boys, but at the time, I had just started my job. I was 17. I was scared.
God.
I didn't want to be responsible for this boy being missing, so I lied. But it wasn't just little statements like this. It was the physical evidence that Matthews found that had the potential to flip this case upside down. If you remember one point when Otis was telling his versions of the story, he talked about taking Adam up to his mother's home in Jacksonville. And there was actually a search done of the place at the time. Well, apparently, they found some bones. Those ended up being animal. But along with bones, they also found a pair of child's green shorts, just like Adam was wearing the day he went missing, and a child's yellow flip-flop-like shoe, also like Adam was wearing the day he went missing. But this is what Matthews found. The evidence was collected, then put right into storage. It was never shown to the family for identification. They never knew that they found it. And from what I gathered, it was never even forensically tested.
Oh my God.
Though it wasn't conclusive proof for Matthews, he was more sure than ever that he was on the right track. He wanted to go back and find everything like this, every little piece of evidence that might have been overlooked before, every corner cut and every stone that was unturned. And what he really wanted was Otis's car. If there was truth to be found, it had to be in that car. He knew the car itself and all of the samples from inside it were long gone. But in all the reports, it was noted that there were like 5 rolls of film taken of the outside and inside of the car. So he keeps requesting them over and over and over and keeps being told like, oh, they can't be located. They're not a thing. They don't exist. They're not here. They lost them. Whatever it is, whether this was by sheer oversight or laziness, Matthews didn't trust it. And he requested them directly from like the records department and learned that, well, there aren't any real pictures. What we have are rolls of film that have never been developed.
So no one even knows what's on them.
No one has any idea what's on them. And no one, again, even bothered to like take a look at them at the actual time when all this went down, when they had his car in their possession. When Matthews got them developed, decades after they were taken, what he sees sends chills down his spine. The car had been sprayed with like aluminol and then treated with light. And on the driver's floorboard were 2 bloody footprints, just like Otis described. He said he got into his car with bloody shoes. But more telling, in the back on the floorboard where Otis said he tossed Adam's head was the distinct image of a face in blood. Revay said that when she saw it, she knew because a mother knows. Mm. And that photo answered everything for her. Now, conspiracists online will tell you that the photo has been doctored, but the overwhelming amount of evidence has shown that Otis Toole took Adam Walsh on that July day in 1981 and killed him. And that's what the Hollywood police announced when they finally closed the case in 2008. Like I said at the top of this show, Adam's case has changed the way America views child abduction and stranger danger. Mm-hmm. His family turned their tragedy into a force, and they have gone on to help so many other families and kids in particular. In the 80s, a movie was made about Adam's case, and at the end of each airing, it aired a total of 3 times, I believe. And at the end, they would always list around like 50 kids who were either runaways, abducted by strangers, kidnapped by one of their parents. And each time, there were a handful of those kids that would get returned home because of this movie and because of all the people watching it.
I mean, even his dad, like you said, he was in the hotel industry, and he changed careers to try to help people after this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he did a 180 with his life. And in addition to the film and America's Most Wanted, his parents have been advocates for a number of laws to change how missing children cases are handled. Their work has helped to allow for the formation of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, as well as the Code Adam Law and RICO. Adam would have been 44 years old today, and I don't know how long he would have lived if Otis Toole hadn't taken his life so abruptly, but I am confident that his memory will live on forever. If you want to see any pictures on this case, you can visit our website, crimejunkiepodcast.com.
You can also find all of our sources cited there, and they are also in the show notes for this episode.
Yep. And we will be back next week with a brand new episode. Crime Junkie is an Audio Chuck production. So what do you think, Chuck? Do you approve?